Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for the Health Report and Explorations, coming up after As It Is.
Hello and welcome to a special edition of As It Is from VOA Learning English. I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. Today, October 1st, 2014, is the 90th birthday of former U.S. President Jimmy Carter. On this program, we look at his very active and interesting life.
There can be no nobler nor more ambitious task for America to undertake on this day of a new beginning.
Jimmy Carter was a peanut farmer, naval officer, state senator, and governor of the southern state of Georgia before becoming the 39th president of the United States. VOA reporter Kane Farabaugh met with Mr. Carter many times after he left the White House. This program is based on Kane Farabaugh's discussions with and research about Mr. Carter.
I, Jimmy Carter, do solemnly swear that I
will... Jimmy Carter was sworn in as president on January 20th, 1977. In a speech to the American people, he promised a government as good as its people.
There can be no nobler nor more ambitious task for America to undertake on this day of a new beginning than to help shape a just and peaceful world.
Mr. Carter was concerned about human rights during his presidency. The 4 years he spent in office were very busy, and a large number of issues affected his presidency. Inflation, rising unemployment, and an oil shortage hurt the economy. The Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan in late 1979. In answer to the invasion, Mr. Carter ordered a boycott of the 1980 Summer Olympics in Moscow. Mr. Carter won foreign policy victories with the Panama Canal Treaty and a peace agreement between Egypt and Israel. But his presidency is most remembered for the Iran hostage crisis, which happened in his final year in the White House. He lost in his effort to win re-election and left office on January 20th, 1981. Mr. Carter said the end of his presidency was the beginning of a new life of fighting disease, building hope, and waging peace as head of the Carter Center.
I look upon the Carter Center work as an extension of what I try to do as president. You know, we brought peace between Israel and Egypt. We opened up a harmonious relationship with Latin America with the Panama Canal treaties. We opened up diplomatic relations with China and things of that kind. And so what I've done since then has been kind of an extension. But I don't think there's any doubt that when I won the Nobel Peace Prize, for instance, it was because of the work of the Carter Center. So I would be perfectly satisfied to have a legacy based on peace and human rights. I mean, who wouldn't?
Jimmy Carter was born 90 years ago in the small southern town of Plains, Georgia. He served as an officer in the U.S. Navy, helping to develop nuclear submarines. In 1953, he returned to Plains to operate his family's peanut farm after the death of his father. Jimmy Carter entered Georgia politics in the 1960s. He served 2 terms as a state senator, and then was elected the state's 76th governor. He served 1 term, from 1971 to 1975. Mr. Carter had no experience as a Washington politician, but he knew Americans were angry with Washington after the presidency of Richard Nixon. Nixon had resigned from office in 1974 because of the Watergate crisis. Still, most political experts believed the former Georgia governor had little chance of success. But in the general election of 1976, he defeated President Gerald Ford, winning 50.1% of the popular vote to Mr. Ford's 48%. President Ford had not been elected president or even vice president. He had only taken office after Mr. Nixon resigned. Jimmy Carter gave credit to his family and his life in Georgia for the success of his presidential campaign. The most successful event in Mr. Carter's presidency was the end of hostilities between Egypt and Israel. The president met with Egyptian President Anwar Sadat and Israeli Prime Minister Menachem Begin at Camp David in Maryland. Those meetings led to the Camp David Agreement and, later, a peace treaty between the two countries.
There had been four wars between Arabs and Israelis in the previous 25 years, with the Egyptians in the leadership, supported by the Soviet Union. They were the only country that could really challenge Israel militarily. And we had success in getting a treaty between Israel and Egypt, not a word of which has ever been violated.
President Carter also negotiated a treaty that gave control of the Panama Canal to Panama, and he established full diplomatic relations with the People's Republic of China. In 1979, a revolution in Iran ousted Shah Reza Pahlavi, who fled to the United States. The U.S. government had strongly supported the Shah for many years. In November, militants attacked the U.S. embassy in Tehran and took 52 Americans hostage. The militants were supporters of an Islamic religious leader, Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini. In April 1980, President Carter approved a military operation to free the hostages. It failed when several military aircraft crashed in the Iranian desert. 8 American service members died. Secretary of State Cyrus Vance, who had opposed the rescue operation, resigned in protest. The crisis led in part to Mr. Carter's defeat in the 1980 presidential election. He lost to former movie actor and California governor Ronald Reagan. The day Mr. Reagan became president, the hostages were released.
With the now liberated Americans who were held hostage.
In 1981, Mr. Carter returned to Plains. He was deeply in debt and unsure about what he should do next. During his time in office, his businesses had been poorly managed. He wrote a book about his presidency and sold some of those businesses to pay his debts. And he made plans for a small library and presidential museum to house papers related to his White House years.
I envisioned to be a tiny thing, where I would have an office and some nice buildings in Atlanta, and that anyone in the world that had an ongoing conflict or a potential conflict could come to me, and I would help them mediate the dispute and stop a war.
But the Carter Center became much more. It has sent representatives to help monitor or watch more than 90 troubled elections. It also has helped end many international disagreements, including a nuclear dispute with North Korea in 1994. It also helped negotiate a peace agreement between Uganda and Sudan. The center also works to improve health and fight diseases in the poorest parts of the world. In 2002, because of his work at the Carter Center, Jimmy Carter was given the Nobel Peace Prize. The former president has written 26 books and is writing at least 2 more, including one about life in his 90s. His books include his autobiography and 3 books on the Middle East conflict. Some of his books have angered people who support Israel. Mr. Carter has lived longer after leaving the White House than any other former president. And Mr. Carter and his vice president, Walter Mondale, have the longest post-presidential partnership in American history. He has been active after his presidency for a longer time than any former American president. And that's our special report on the 90th birthday of former U.S. President Jimmy Carter. I'm Jim Tedder in Washington.
The elected president, a man whose roots are in the same place as ours, a man who, like us, knows what it means to work for a living. He's Georgia's Jimmy Carter, and the best thing that could happen to the South in our lifetime would be to make him president. Vote for him on November 2nd.
The Health Report is next, followed by Explorations. You can read and listen to our programs and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health Report. Overweight, out of shape, fat. Whatever you want to call it, many studies show that children around the world are becoming less active and less physically fit. The result is an increase in obesity, the condition of being severely overweight, also diabetes and other diseases. It is a major concern for public health officials, and it may be that fitness levels affect more than physical health. For students, it may also affect test scores. VOA's Carol Pearson was in Redondo Beach, California recently, with more than 700 children. They were walking to school with parents, and in some cases, even their dogs. The students do this once a week. The children may not know it, but they walk to reduce childhood obesity. It is also meant to increase their activity or fitness level.
It's a good way to get the kids exercising in the morning.
For the kids, it's just fun.
I like walking to school with my friends. One of my friends' name is Alyssa, and we talk about a lot of things at school, how hard our homework is, and all of the fun activities we're doing.
A study from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention shows that most American children are physically unfit. But children in other countries also face this problem. Health officials across the world are concerned about rising rates of obesity and type 2 diabetes in children as young as 8. This type of diabetes is directly related to poor diet and lack of physical activity. The World Health Organization advises that children between the ages of 5 and 17 get at least 60 minutes of physical activity every day. The activity should be moderate to very energetic or vigorous. Studies on children and exercise show that fitness is good for more than just physical health. A U.S. Institute of Medicine study shows that physical activity helps students with their studies. Harold Cole led the study. He is a professor of epidemiology at the University of Texas. He researches how diseases spread among populations.
The evidence is really emerging in the last 5 or 6 years, both cognitive studies as well as brain imaging studies and others, that show that the acute effects of a bout or two of physical activity on blood perfusion in the brain, in the centers that really help children learn, recall things faster, think faster, and actually more likely to achieve their full academic potential compared to children who are not physically active.
A University of Illinois study shows similar results. Professor Charles Hillman led the study. Mr. Hillman says children in his study who had physical activity on a usual basis improved in school. And that's the Health Report. I'm Anna Mateo.
¶¶ Welcome to Explorations. I'm Mario Ritter. Today, Steve Ember and Barbara Klein tell about three men who had a big influence on modern sound and communications technologies. We start with the simple beginnings of computer-generated music.
Max Vernon Matthews has been called the father of computer music. He created electronic tools so that people could use computers as musical instruments. He had a huge influence on the development of electronic music and how it is written, recorded, and played. In 1957, Max Matthews wrote the first computer program that enabled a computer to create sound and play it back. At the time, he was working as an engineer at Bell Laboratories in New Jersey. His computer program was called Music. It enabled a large IBM computer to play a 17-second piece of music that he had written. The computer was so slow, it would have taken an hour to play the piece of music in 17 seconds. For that reason, Matthews moved the work to a tape player, which could be sped up to play the music at a normal speed. He later said that the sound quality of the musical notes was not great, but the technical importance of the music was huge.
The science fiction writer Arthur C. Clarke visited Bell Laboratories in the 1960s. He heard a computer sing the song Daisy Bell on devices and programs developed by Max Matthews and other engineers. Clarke noted this technology in his book, 2001, A Space Odyssey, which was later made into a movie. Matthews continued creating other versions of the music program. He became interested in how computers could help musicians outside recording studios. The Groove program he developed was the first computer program made for live performances. He also developed an electronic device he called the Radio Baton. The device looks like two drumsticks. It enables the user to control the speed and sound levels of orchestral music playing on a computer. The user does this by moving the two sticks on a special electronic surface.
Max Matthews had a long and productive career. He worked with composers like John Cage and Edgar Varèse. He helped to create a center for research in computer music in Paris. And he taught at the Stanford University's Center for Computer Research in Music and Acoustics in California. Matthews told Wired.com that he believed modern musicians are not making full use of the power of computer music. He said a violin always sounds like a violin. But with a computer, the way a violin sounds is unlimited. He said he did not want computer sounds to replace live music, but he said he hoped laptop computers would one day be considered serious instruments.
That was a recording of Ludwig von Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. This work had a surprising influence on the technology of recorded music. Sony Corporation official Norio Ohga helped to develop the compact disc in the late 1970s. He strongly pushed for CDs to be larger and with a longer playing time. He wanted them to hold 75 minutes of music so that they could store all of Beethoven's Ninth Symphony on one disc. This way, listeners could enjoy the musical work without any break.
Norio Ohga was born in Japan in 1930. He grew up playing the piano and taking singing lessons. He studied music at the Tokyo National University of Fine Arts and Music. His aim was to become an opera singer. As a young man, Ohga reportedly owned a tape recorder that did not work well. He sent a letter detailing the problems to the manufacturer. The owners of the company were struck by his knowledge about music and technology. They asked him to serve as a part-time advisor. The company later became known as Sony. In 1959, Ohga began working full-time with Sony.
He worked in the Sony design department and influenced the look of the company's electronic products. He also worked on advertising campaigns and what kinds of products it developed. Sony and Philips, another electronics manufacturer, worked together to create a new storage device for digital sound, the compact disc. The new technology had its critics, but Ohga and others believed that the excellent sound quality of the CD would make it popular. Sony began producing CD recordings in 1982. The compact disc changed the electronics industry and the way people listened to music.
Norio Ohga served as president of Sony starting in 1982 and chief executive officer starting 7 years later. He once said that leading a company was like leading an orchestra. He said a business leader had to work to build on the talents of the people in an organization, just like a director must work to bring out the best in members of an orchestra. Under his leadership, Sony expanded into music and movies. He believed that a company that made electronic devices should also make products to use with the electronics. Norio Ohga helped make the company an entertainment leader by pushing the company to make electronics as well as music, movies, and video games.
Hubert Joseph Schlafly was an electrical engineer who helped change the way actors, politicians, and other people speak on television. In 1950, he and two other men developed the teleprompter. One co-worker, Fred Barton, was an actor. He had an idea for a tool that would help television actors read their lines without having to memorize them. The other co-worker was Irving Kahn. He worked as vice president of radio and television at 20th Century Fox. The first teleprompter involved a person who turned a long piece of paper printed with tall letters. As the actor read the lines, another person would move the paper ahead on the device. The teleprompter was first used on a television program called The First 100 Years. Later versions used television screens to show the words that were to be read. Hub Schlafly and his co-workers believed that many companies would want to buy the teleprompter. So they left their jobs and created the Teleprompter Corporation to sell their invention.
In 1952, former President Herbert Hoover became the first politician to use a teleprompter. The former president was speaking to delegates at the Republican National Convention in Chicago. For a brief time, he stopped reading and began to talk about a subject not written in his speech. When Hoover wanted to continue the speech, the words on the teleprompter were not moving, so he called out for the device to restart. Many reporters wrote about that incident, creating a new level of publicity for the teleprompter. The teleprompter soon became popular with politicians who could use it to face the television camera while reading prepared statements instead of looking down at their notes. Soon, the devices were used for almost all live television broadcasts.
The Teleprompter Corporation also worked on developing new television and cable technologies. By 1970, it was the country's largest cable company. Hub Schlafly worked with Hughes Aircraft to develop video broadcasts using microwave transmission. He also helped organize the first use of a satellite to carry television broadcasts. Schlafly left the Teleprompter Corporation in the 1970s, but he continued working to support the development of satellite television.
In 2008, Schlafly became a member of the Cable Television Hall of Fame.
It's a great honor to be included as one of the recipients of the 2008 Cable Television Hall of Fame.
During his acceptance speech, Schlafly announced that this award ceremony marked another special event. It was the first time he had ever spoken in public with the help of a teleprompter.
This program was written and produced by Dana Demange. Barbara Klein and Steve Ember were your announcers. I'm Mario Ritter. You can read and listen to our programs and get podcasts at voaspecialenglish.com. Join us again next week for another Explorations program on the Voice of America.